The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter and then from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And first, from the October 2024 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. Here's a section called News Briefs. And the first question is, should you beef up your strength training program? The recommendation to do strength training twice a week doesn't mean you have to pump a lot of iron and become a bodybuilder. Doing body weight exercise or using small dumbbells or resistance bands does a nice job of keeping muscles strong. But recent evidence suggests that lifting heavier loads might have longer lasting benefits. The study published online June 18, 2024 by BMJ, Open Sport and Exercise Medicine, involved 400 physically active people, average age 71, who were randomly assigned to one of three groups. People in the first group spent a year doing three weekly sessions of heavy, machine-based weightlifting. Those in the second group did strength training three times a week with resistance bands and body weight exercise. The others were told to simply keep up their usual activity. After the initial year, participants chose how active to be, and their muscle strength was measured periodically. 4 years after the study began, the exercisers who did heavy weightlifting still had strong leg muscles, while people in the other two groups had lost leg strength. The study indicates that intensive strength training is beneficial, even in older age. If you want to increase the amount of weight you lift, do it gradually, and consider working with a personal trainer for guidance. The second short article is entitled, Harvard Scientists Find Another Secret to Longevity, Feeling Grateful. Counting your blessings is tied to better emotional and social well-being and higher quality sleep. Now, a Harvard study published online July 3, 2024, by JAMA Psychiatry, suggests that feeling grateful might also be a key to living longer. The research involved 49,000 women, average age 79, who answered questions in 2016 about how thankful they felt about various aspects of their life. Researchers followed up with participants 3 years later. Compared to women who'd originally reported feeling the least grateful, those who reported feeling the most grateful had a 9% lower risk of dying during the study period. The study was observational and doesn't prove that gratitude extends life. It might bring you more joy, though. Give it a try. Each day, write down three things you're thankful for. They can be large or small, like a nice conversation with a neighbor, or some pretty foliage you saw that day. If the practice fosters more gratitude, keep it going. Finally, a brief article, Harvard researchers find that irregular sleep patterns are linked to diabetes. Getting the right amount of sleep is essential for good health, but if the duration of your nightly Z's varies significantly, you might be boosting your diabetes risk, suggests a Harvard-led study published online July 17, 2024, by Diabetes Care. Researchers asked more than 84,000 diabetes-free people, average age 62, to wear activity trackers for a week and then followed their health for 7 years. People whose sleep duration varied the most, fluctuating by more than an hour from night to night, had a 34% higher risk for diabetes, compared with people whose sleep duration was more consistent. The association was stronger among those who slept more than 8 hours per night. However, the association was also present among those who slept 7 to 8 hours per night. This suggests that even for those who get enough sleep every night, maintaining a consistent sleep schedule is important, says Sina Kianursi, the lead author and researcher at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. The study doesn't prove that inconsistent sleep causes diabetes, but other studies have tied varying sleep duration to diabetes risk factors, including a big belly and high blood sugar, blood pressure, and triglycerides, a type of fat in the blood. Now we're going to turn to the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is the Mayo Clinic Health Letter of September 2024. And here's a very pertinent article entitled Age-Related Macular Degeneration. Keep your vision despite the diagnosis. Catherine Carroll witnessed her grandmother's vision decline over time. Late in life, her grandmother saw the world only in shadows, listening to her beloved soap operas and Minnesota Twin baseball games instead of watching. Carroll's father faced a slower but similar decline. Both of them lived with the same condition, age-related macular degeneration. And for both, the condition progressively caused legal blindness. In 2008, a trip to the eye doctor by Carroll, then 59, to ask about vision surgery resulted in a diagnosis of the same condition. The doctor assured her that her life wouldn't be as affected, thanks to better treatment options being available. I wanted to believe him, but it was hard after seeing what my grandmother and my dad experienced, she says. But at the same time, it gave me so much hope. Age-related macular degeneration is a chronic eye disease that develops when tissues of the macula, an area at the back of the inner eye, begin to deteriorate. The macula is part of the light-detecting layer of tissue, the retina, that's responsible for the central area of the field of vision and the ability to clearly see fine details. There are two forms of age-related macular degeneration. The first is dry AMD. This type occurs in about 75% of people with AMD. It only accounts for 10% of legal blindness caused by AMD because it develops slowly. What causes dry AMD is not fully understood. The hallmark sign is clumps of cellular waste called drusen. The drusen can be seen within the macula during an eye exam. Small drusen may develop without causing any noticeable effect on vision. Larger drusen can develop and merge, leading to breakdown of light-sensitive cells of the macula and the gradual process of AMD-related vision loss. Then there is wet AMD. This form, also called exudative or neovascular AMD, comes on more abruptly and is responsible for the most severe vision loss with AMD. Wet AMD starts as dry AMD. At some point in the disease process, new atypical blood vessels begin to grow within the macula. These fragile new vessels are prone to leaking blood and fluid beneath the macular tissues, causing swelling. Eventually, this may lead to damage and scarring of areas critical to central vision. Symptoms of dry and wet AMD can be similar. The main difference is that wet AMD can cause vision decline within weeks to months, whereas dry AMD unfolds over years to decades. Another important difference is that dry AMD typically, but not always, involves both eyes at the same time. Wet AMD often starts with increased symptoms in one eye. With a high risk, the other eye will develop wet AMD within 5 years. Both types may cause blurred vision, causing a gradual haziness and difficulty seeing fine details like small type. Street signs or faces may be harder to see. Visual distortions may occur in which straight lines appear bent or wavy. Colors are dulled. There is difficulty adjusting to low light. And dark spots may form in your vision, or the need to scan your eyes around to get a complete view of an object. In developed countries, AMD is a leading cause of severe vision loss in people 60 and older. It causes vision loss in just 15% of those who have the condition. It doesn't cause total blindness since side vision isn't affected. Still, the decline and possible loss of central vision can impact your ability to read, drive, cook, and enjoy hobbies and other pursuits. There is no cure for AMD, but improved treatment options can help delay vision loss and preserve what vision you have, and in some cases even reverse some vision loss. If you notice vision changes, see an eye specialist promptly. The sooner wet AMD is treated, the better the chances of limiting vision loss. Diagnosing AMD requires a complete eye exam, but you can help identify new changes to your vision earlier by periodically looking at an Amsler grid at right. It's important to test your vision in each eye individually by closing your eyes one at a time. Treatment for wet AMD typically includes medications to stop the growth of atypical blood vessels and reduce the leakage of fluid and blood. These drugs inhibit a specific protein, vascular endothelial growth factor, that triggers new blood vessel growth and leakage. As such, these drugs are called anti-VEGF, or vascular endothelial growth factor drugs. And they include aflibercept or Eylea, bevacizumab or Avastin, faricimab or Vabysmo, and ranibizumab or Lucent. These drugs are injected directly into the eye every 4 to 6 weeks. Research has shown that they are significantly more effective when treatment begins soon after diagnosis. Depending on the response, injections may be given less often. About 1 in 3 people given anti-VEGF drugs for wet AMD have moderate vision improvement. These drugs substantially reduce the risk of further vision loss, though some people will still lose vision. Some people with wet AMD may benefit from laser-based therapy options that became available before the anti-VEGF drugs were developed. The procedures, photodynamic therapy and laser photocoagulation, involve the use of special lasers to seal off or destroy atypical blood vessels. In the early stages of dry AMD, there's no specific treatment. But it's important to address risk factors. Stopping smoking may have the strongest effects on slowing AMD progression. With intermediate to advanced dry AMD, there is a special supplement formulation with antioxidant properties that helps to reduce risk of further progression in about 25% of people. The formulation hasn't been shown to prevent AMD before it occurs. Though the nutrient amounts in commercial products can vary somewhat, the studied formulation of these supplements, often referred to as AREDS S2, includes 80 milligrams of zinc, 2 milligrams of copper, 500 milligrams of vitamin C, 400 international units of vitamin E, 10 milligrams of lutein, and 2 milligrams of zeaxanthin. With dry AMD at any stage, it's also important to regularly monitor your vision. Rapidly changing vision warrants a prompt visit with an eye doctor. Monitoring includes regular eye exams and also may include periodically checking your vision at home, such as with an Amsler grid. It's been 16 years since Catherine Carroll was diagnosed with AMD. Her condition so far has not caused blindness, as happened to her family members before her. Immediately after her diagnosis, she started taking supplements recommended by her healthcare team. She has annual eye exams, diligently wears sun protective glasses, and regularly monitors her sight. I'm so grateful to be able to say I don't think much about having macular degeneration, she says. But Carol's success story doesn't fit everybody's experience. Many people with AMD eventually have a vision decline that affects daily function. However, there are many tools and technologies available to help you navigate your degree of vision loss and optimize what vision remains. These include magnifiers, reading glasses, and special functions on personal electronic devices. Your primary care team, eye doctor, low vision specialist, and occupational therapist can help. Some people with advanced dry AMD in both eyes may benefit from a telescopic lens implant in one eye. This mini telescope focuses images into healthier parts of your macula. Although it can be effective, it takes an extensive rehabilitation program to train your brain to maximize function of the device. Your care team can help decide if you're a good candidate. Now, once again, from the Mayo Clinic health letter, this is the September issue. There's an article about physical therapy, a key piece of your healthcare team. You may think about physical therapists mostly in the role of helping you recover from an injury, a surgery, or a medical condition. But their involvement in your care doesn't have to only occur after a health event. Physical therapists also are trained in preventive care, especially to address mobility concerns and symptoms. As you age, it's a good idea to touch base with a physical therapist and establish a relationship, says Pamela Klein, PT-DPT, a specialist in geriatric physical therapy at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. That could mean an annual visit to a physical therapist as you age. It also could mean seeing a physical therapist first for some medical conditions. Due in part to a shortage of family care doctors in some part of the United States, some medical systems now have other health professionals, including physical therapists, in place to help fill certain gaps. This is sometimes called secondary care, but in fact this model is showing early promise in improving outcomes and reducing costs. Physical therapists are most likely to be called in for care of people who have muscle or joint pain that affects the neck, back, shoulders, hips, knees, ankles, or feet. But they also provide effective care for a range of other medical conditions, like balance issues, incontinence, and recovery from a stroke, acute illness, or concussion. Physical therapists can help reduce your fall risk. As you age, your risk of falls, and especially of falls that result in significant health problems, rises. Falls make up about 60% of total non-fatal visits to emergency rooms for people 65 and older. Falling once is associated with falling again, and falls are a major reason that older adults stop living independently. Falls are also a leading cause of death in older adults. Physical therapists can test older adults for subtle signs of weakness in joints and muscles and for early warning signs of balance issues. This testing helps screen for fall risk and helps screen for little declines in functional mobility that would increase fall risk, says Dr. Klein. It also helps keep people more mobile and more active in their lives. Physical therapists can also help you to stay more active. Trying a new activity like pickleball, physical therapy is a great resource if you're thinking about taking up a new sports activity in your area to make sure that you don't end up with a weekend warrior injury, Dr. Klein says. Visits with your physical therapist before starting an exercise or activity can help to address areas to strengthen or stretch before trying a particular sport. Also, physical therapists will help keep health care affordable. You've heard the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. As it relates to fall risk in older Americans, each fall with injury generates $35,000 in health care costs. Medicare takes care of most fall-related claims in older Americans, but a good number of falls are preventable, especially with a regimen of stretches and exercises tailored to personal needs. Physical therapists are trained to assess risk and develop prevention plans. Those plans involve guided exercises, both physical and mental, plus other measures designed to improve overall health and address specific needs. Reducing fall risk is an area of preventive medicine where studies have shown that treatment by a physical therapist produces major savings. Other conditions that have been shown to be significantly more cost-effective when treated by physical therapists include carpal tunnel syndrome, inadequate blood flow to the limbs or vascular claudication, knee osteoarthritis, tendon or ligament issues, low back pain, and rehabilitation after cancer treatment. Also, physical therapists can help with rehabilitation and recovery in a variety of situations. Physical therapists are best known for helping aid recovery from serious injuries like surgeries, broken bones, or hospitalizations from a stroke or a heart attack. The physical therapists have other roles too. They can help people manage dizziness, recover from concussion, and manage cancer treatment like chemotherapy. They also can help people adjust to life with or without a prosthetic limb after a limb amputation. Now, once in this Mayo Clinic health letter of September 2024, we're going to turn to a section called Second Opinion. And the first question is, I've been using ibuprofen to manage my arthritis pain, but lately it's not providing enough relief. Why is this? Nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, and the names for ibuprofen include Advil, Motrin, and others, effectively treat short-term acute pain. They also have a so-called ceiling effect. A limit is how much pain they can control. This means higher doses are rarely more effective and may cause more side effects like gastrointestinal bleeding and kidney problems. Treating pain with medications is complex. Medications that are appropriate for short-term pain may not be appropriate when used long-term. The higher the dose or the longer you take the medication, the greater the risk of side effects. Extended use of certain medications can lead to developing tolerance, meaning that over time you may require higher doses to achieve the same level of pain relief. Medications alone are rarely effective for chronic pain. They are usually one part of a treatment plan. Work with your primary health care team or a pain specialist to create a comprehensive plan. This might include lifestyle approaches like diet and exercise, counseling, or physical therapy. Some medications used to treat other health conditions, including certain antidepressants and anti-seizure medications, can influence pain signals or chemical processes that contribute to pain. Severe pain may require specific treatments, like joint replacement if you have pain from significant arthritis. Medications should be used judiciously, weighing the benefits against potential serious side effects. Medication is generally considered beneficial if it reduces pain, improves function and allows you to continue everyday activities while causing minimal or no side effects. As you consider the role of medications in controlling your pain, remember a drug that works for one person may not work for you. And then very briefly, there's a question about digital rectal exams. Although it may be embarrassing and uncomfortable, a digital rectal exam can provide useful insight into diagnosing prostate cancer and other medical conditions. During the exam, a healthcare professional inserts a gloved, lubricated finger into the rectum. Then, in men, the healthcare professional feels the back wall of the prostate gland for enlargement, tenderness, lumps, or hard spots. The digital rectal exam is often used in addition to a PSA blood test because an exam might detect prostate cancer even if PSA levels don't cause alarm. Studies have shown that some men with prostate cancer don't have elevated PSA levels. This is because some prostate cancers are too small to cause higher PSA levels, and some aggressive prostate cancers don't produce PSA. As a result, these cancers may not be detected by blood test alone. A combination of the rectal exam and a PSA test may be more strongly recommended if you have risk factors for prostate cancer. One of the risk factors is being a black male or having a close family history of prostate cancer. Some recent studies have shown that a routine digital rectal exam on its own adds little value in the early detection of prostate cancer. Some healthcare professionals use the exam only when symptoms are present. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.